This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Admission time. To me, news used to be an almost holy craft. Journalists were women and men of honor, toiling mightily to find the truth, then reporting it as fully, fairly, and objectively as possible. But after reading Bruce Williams' new book, I may have to rethink things. In that book, Williams and his co-author examine the history of news media in America and make some predictions about its future. If you think that future should be fair and balanced, our guest is likely to disappoint. But if you'd like a chance to ponder what really has made news in the past and why, as well as what the equivalent of headlines are likely to look like in the years ahead, then do stay tuned. Your chance to confab with Virginia media scholar Bruce Williams is coming up right after this news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The book is titled After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment. Its co-author, University of Virginia media scholar Bruce Williams, is our guest. If you'd like to talk to him, our phone lines are now open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Bruce Williams, thank you for making time for us.
Oh, my pleasure, Tom.
Why is your book titled After Broadcast News?
What we wanted to signal in the title is that we live in a very unsettled and volatile media environment. And I think we all know this. Everyone who just walks around today understands that we face a bewildering number of choices for getting information about the world around us. And there are all sorts of debates about what's good information, what's bad information, and so on. But what we wanted to signal in the title is it's important to see that this environment we're in now comes after what we're calling a media regime that was dominated by basically the network news broadcasts and the network news divisions. And we're in a different moment now, and which is after broadcast news, and we're not going back to the model of political information that we had at the end of the 20th century.
The era of broadcast news, in your mind, Bruce Williams, goes from when to when?
The roots of it are clearly in the 1930s with the emergence of radio and the way the federal government and state governments adapted to this emerging new mass medium. But what we're more specifically talking about is really the post-World War II period, where televisions come into everyone's household, and there are a limited number of networks, all with public service obligations, and they all broadcast at the same time a network news broadcast, and then usually local news. And at its height in the 1980s, 8 out of every 10 TV sets that were turned on during that time were turned into a local news broadcast.
So let's say then this era starts somewhere around the mid-1950s,
yeah,
when the networks were all doing at least 15-minute national newscasts,
start, right,
followed by local newscast, eventually expanded on most stations to half-hour and half-hour. So mid-1950s to when? When did the era of broadcast news begin to end?
It really starts to break down in the 1990s with the emergence of the Internet, but also the dramatic explosion in the number of television stations that people have. You know, we take cable television for granted today, but there was a time when most households were getting, you know, at most 5 stations. So the number of television stations there are, the advent of the Internet, all sorts of media, new media technologies, I think, begin to disrupt and undermine what we would call that media regime.
So give or take a couple of years, we're probably talking from about 1955 up until about 1995,
right,
when most Americans were getting most of their news from television and from
the major
networks. And during that period, based on what I'm reading in your book, Bruce, after broadcast news, it seems as if certain rules and expectations about what news should be came to be adopted and expected. Tell me about that.
Well, Michael and I, my co-author's name is Michael Della Carpini. He is dean of the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. We argue that part of what we think is very important and what we do in the first half of our book is look at the question of the relationship between media and democracy in a broader historical perspective. And so what we're interested in is how it is that over time citizens have gotten political information. How they've gotten the information that they need, or maybe how they've been frustrated in getting that information, that they need to be citizens in a democratic society.
And that's a good point, because although we are talking about what news has been, about what news is today and what may be news in the future, you're most interested in the type of information that influences decision-making in a democracy, how people view their political environment, what decisions they make about it, not so much what happened during Madonna's halftime show at the Super Bowl.
Well, I part of the point that we're trying to make is that a lot of the distinctions that we take for granted today between news and entertainment, the frustration that a lot of people have when they throw around words like the dumbing down of news and newspapers, the rise of infotainment, things like that. We think that those titles, those labels are misleading and not very useful anymore, because the distinction between news and entertainment, the idea that there is a natural distinction between that, we argue really is a product of what we're calling the age of broadcast news. And it's never been very clear. When does a story about, let's say, something we talk about in our book, about President Clinton or, a sitting president or a candidate for office, when does it move from being a serious piece of what we might call news to something sensational or prurient? Well, that distinction is tough to maintain when you look at, as we did, the newspapers in the early days of the American Republic, when the first rumors about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings were thrown around in newspapers. That was a time when the newspapers of the day and the debates of the day looked and sounded a lot more like the National Enquirer than the New York Times. And we think that it's important to understand that broad sweep.
So that's one of the reasons I ask about the expectations that got set up in this era of broadcast news. Let me ask the question this way, if I could, Bruce Williams. In this book, After Broadcast News, the impression I was getting about what you and Michael Della Carpini, your co-author, were saying, is that from maybe the 1920s to the 1930s with newspapers, and then certainly from the 1950s on for the next few decades in network TV news and newspapers, certain understandings seemed to be agreed upon by people who called themselves journalists and by people who were on the receiving end of news reporting about what news was or should be. And that it should be accurate, it should be fair, it should be reported to the greatest extent possible in an objective, neutral manner. You're nodding your head. So in essence, my understanding of what you were saying is that there was almost a century where Americans got this sense of what news was, that isn't necessarily what Americans used to think news was, or maybe will think news is in the future?
I wouldn't push it back to the 1930s, but to address your point, I think that what we had, what most Americans had, and I think older Americans today take as their common sense understanding of the world, is that we had a system where there were very few places that we could go to get political information. And that, by the 1960s and 70s and 80s, that came down to the expectation was that a good citizen was going to spend 30 minutes every night listening to one of the three nightly network news broadcasts. And if you were really motivated, you might read a newspaper in the morning.
But your expectation about what news was,
yes,
your definition of news, involved it being accurate and objective and dependable, that you were getting a fair picture of what was contained in that reporting.
Yes, and I think that the issue for us is that there were advantages and disadvantages to that system. One of the
I'm not saying what people were getting, but that was sort of an understanding of what the expectation of what news was.
Yes, people expected that they were going to get their political information from professional journalists. And professional journalists are, as any profession is, they're committed to a certain set of best practices.
And one of the reasons I'm pushing you on this point, Bruce, is because I think you make it quite clear in this book, is that there are many people living in America today who went through decades, whether they were born in the 30s or 40s or 50s or 60s, of being in an environment where this definition of the news sort of permeated our society. And for those of us who are that old, it may be a little bit difficult to understand that that wasn't always the definition of news.
Absolutely. One of the experiences that really helped Michael and I, or pushed us in the way that we went in working on this project, was we spent a day in the Philadelphia Public Library reading 19th century newspapers. And when you open up the pages of the New York Times in the 1860s and 1870s, it looks nothing like the New York Times today. And what I mean by that is there's nothing in that newspaper that we would call news provided by journalists. There might be an excerpt from a novel on the first page. The front page of newspapers had the shipping news. The political information was simply on the second page, and it was basically transcripts of politicians' speeches.
And it wasn't unusual for there to be opinion of some kind on the front page of that paper or any other in that time
frame. Because what papers would publish is perhaps the information about Europe would come from people who wrote letters to the editor. They were friends with the editor, and they would correspond with their friends who were traveling all over the world. And that really is why we call reporters foreign correspondents, because long ago they used to be just people who were writing letters.
Who corresponded.
Yes. And if you go back further, as I was saying about, the early 19th century, again, the newspapers were very partisan. No one could read the newspapers of the early 19th century and think that what this was some kind of disinterested chronicling of facts or what tried to be objective.
So to you who are listening, the information that you use today to base your political viewpoints, where does that come from? Newspapers, radio, TV, social media, something else? As far as your primary source of information, how is that different today than it was 10 or 20 years ago? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, find us listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We're talking with the lead author of the new book, After Broadcast News. His name, Bruce Williams. We're going to also ask him about how he sees the future of news when we get back from this break. Don Henley making clear back in 1982 what he thought of television news. What do you think of the world of news? What do you think news is? What do you think it's likely to be in the future? You're welcome to join this discussion with Bruce Williams, author of the new book, After Broadcast News, either by joining us on Facebook with a post. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight, or by phone, 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. I got to tell you, Bruce, that back in the 80s, when I was still working in television news, that song was just the favorite of all of the news photographers and most of the news reporters. Whenever we would be out in a car on a story traveling someplace and that would come on the radio, whoever was driving the car would always tune it up. And I always thought that kind of strange because it was certainly criticizing what television news had become, so much focused on sensationalism and garbage. I think Don Henley uses a stronger word there that I probably shouldn't repeat on the air. Is there something about the quality of reporting that began to go on in the 80s and 90s that influenced how things changed?
I think so, yes. And there is a whole slew of communication researchers that have investigated this period. And part of the argument that I'm convinced by is that a lot of that had to do with what was going on in the realm of acquisitions in terms of which corporations were buying which media organizations. And you had a period in the 1980s, really up until now, where there was increasing concentration of ownership, that large corporations, and if you watch 30 Rock, as I do, they make fun of this all the time. Who owns NBC? Is it GE or the Shinehart Wig Company of, you know, Pyongyang, North Korea? But there's a serious, you know, a serious point behind that, that the news divisions and the organizations that they were housed in, which used to be seen as parts of media organizations that were not judged by profit and loss, that did not have to make money, if you will. And the reason for that is because of the public service obligations that networks assumed when they were granted the monopoly right by the government to broadcast at a particular frequency. As larger
and
larger...
this was really the local stations, right?
Well,
it was the local stations who owned the licenses.
But it was also the national networks that, you know, if you look at, and it's part of the history of this period, if you look at CBS and the establishment of CBS News, first radio, then television, this was seen as it was the part of the corporation that was doing public service, that it was not to be judged in the same way.
But it wasn't doing public service out of the good-heartedness of the corporate powers that operated the networks or the local stations. It was doing public service because their sense was if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be within the government regulations that allowed them a license to be on the air.
Absolutely. And that's another reason that it's important to understand media historically, is that in the 1930s in the United States, as radio became a new mass medium, there was a debate in the United States about what we're going to do with these airwaves, what we're going to do with radio. And part of the argument was whether we were going as a nation, going to turn over the public airwaves, and so it was the government that was going to decide this, whether we were going to give them over to private corporations, as we did, that were free to make as much money as they could through commercials and advertising, as long as they also served a public service obligation. That was the trade. But the other argument that was made is no, radio and later television is too important to turn over to the private sector. And what we ought to do is do what Britain had already done and create something like the BBC, national public media. And the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was established around the same time. And so the way that debate turned out, that we went down the road of turning over the airwaves to private corporations in exchange for them meeting a public service obligation, that shaped the way media organizations developed. They and news, their news division, came to be seen as where they were serving that public service obligation.
So would this be a fair analogy, that a huge corporation finds that by producing a certain product, it can make lots and lots of money, and it has to have a government license in order to make that product? And in this case, the product is having millions of people watch you and then selling opportunities to talk to those people to advertisers. In order to keep that mechanism going, in order to keep that huge machine oiled, you had to satisfy the government to keep your license. And in essence, your news departments kind of became the oil that kept the machinery going. And if you stopped running those news departments, you wouldn't be able to get your license renewed every 3 years. And all of a sudden, this wonderful mechanism that was making you lots of money would go away. The government would pull your license.
Absolutely.
And something about that economic model changed that then began to influence how people experienced news, as far as at least television and radio was concerned.
Yes, and that's a terribly important point, because in the end, the quality and quality of the news we receive through almost all commercial channels is a luxury or a benefit that corporations can provide because they're making enough money through advertising. As long as newspapers were healthy when it came to generating advertising dollars, they could keep putting out a newspaper every day. As long as the major networks were making enough money through the advertising they were selling to support the kind of programming that we see and to support a news division, that is pretty expensive if you're going to do it right. You have to have foreign bureaus, you have to have lots of reporters, and on and on.
Far more expensive to do it for television than for newspaper, when you have to pay for all the complicated equipment and keeping your broadcast signal rather than just a reporter with a pencil and a pad working for a newspaper.
Or radio is much more inexpensive than television.
So one of the other things that changed is beginning about the 1980s, do you say in your book After Broadcast News, is that at least as far as television and radio was concerned, this incentive, this economic incentive to have to do public service through news began to change because government regulation began to change. And not only did bigger and bigger corporations be able to own more and more radio and television stations, but they didn't have to worry so much about doing news in order to keep their licenses.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I mean, the first is that the license renewal process, even though there were attempts to strengthen it in the 1970s, by the 80s and 90s is not a serious process. Stations don't lose their license. But the second thing, I think, is that the very idea that these networks and stations are supposed to be providing news, part of the problem is, as Michael and I talk about in the book, is it's very unclear what that is, what the news is. When something that, you know, Peter Jennings or Walter Cronkite or Katie Couric are reporting on in their 30-minute broadcasts, when does that stop being news and start being something else? And that definition is not very clear. We think that the reason we think it's natural is because these major corporations, they set up things they called news divisions, and we all knew that's what they did. So we think it's important to take a step back and think more generally about the question of political information and who's providing it and what rules they're using to provide it. And that's where you get in to, I think, a very useful understanding or a set of questions about the advantages and disadvantages of professional journalism. And we think it's important to understand that there were very significant advantages to having professional journalists at the gates between the political world and citizens. But there were also considerable disadvantages, and we're in a media system now where, once again, we are going to be deciding what a new media regime looks like. And so it's important to not take what we're passing out of as sort of the only model available, because it's not.
So tell us more about the advantages and disadvantages of that model that you say we have now passed through, the model of the broadcast news era, in which so many people probably listening today got their idea of what news was. Advantages, disadvantages of that model.
I think that that one of the major advantages that we have lost today is the size of the audience for the nightly network news, that every night you could count on most Americans watching one of these three network news broadcasts, which were pretty much the same. And that meant that everyone had a common understanding of what the important issues of the day were and what the basic facts of the matter were. You could disagree politically about in terms of your position on the issues, but there was much more, I think, consensus over what the facts of the matter were. Another advantage of professional journalism is that they are professionals. And what that means is the rules that they are committed to using in providing the information that we get, they are pretty clear. Journalists are supposed to be nonpartisan. They're supposed to get both sides of the story. They're supposed to source their stories, and on and on. And the advantages of that, I think, are twofold. One is you can look at those standards and you can say, hey, you didn't do that. Jason Blair, you made stuff up, and so the New York Times is going to fire you. Or you can say, look, this particular report, you got the Democrat side, you didn't talk to Republicans. The other advantage of it is you can say, as a lot of scholarship does, those aren't the only rules we could have. There's something wrong with the very rules themselves. But it was possible to have a discussion of that. Those were very strong advantages. The disadvantages were that the news we got was heavily biased towards elites. It was, by and large, shaped every day by what political elites in Washington were doing. Reporters were not very sensitive to stories that were not big deals in Washington or in a state capital as well. And we found that out, I think, in things like the run-up to the Gulf War or even going back to Vietnam, that because of the way journalists did their job, they were very, it was very difficult for them to report critically on things when political elites agreed on them. One of the reasons it was so difficult for journalists to criticize the Vietnam War was that there wasn't a split between the Democrats and the Republicans on that issue for a long time. And so all of that is criticizable. As well, it was very difficult to get feedback. It was very difficult for users, the listeners, the consumers of the news, to really express their own opinions about the news. Also, in that period when we thought we knew what the news was, it took our attention away from other important media that carry important political messages as well. If you're as old as I am, and I won't say how old I am, but I'm old enough to remember the 60s and 70s.
We got pictures of you on our Facebook page. People can say that your hair is white, white or gray.
At least I have it, yeah. So that's good for me. That music, movies, novels were all important in shaping people's political attitudes. But we don't really think of that. in ways that make it difficult to really understand the way in which citizens are forming and getting information about the world.
The book is titled After Broadcast News, Media Regimes, Democracy, and the New Information Environment. Its lead author, media and political science researcher Bruce Williams, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. So we've passed through, according to you, this era of broadcast news. When it comes to news that influences political decision-making, what era are we in now, Bruce Williams?
It's interesting because Michael and I go back and forth on this.
Michael, your co-author.
Yeah, my co-author. It seems clear to us that whatever else is going on, we are not in the age of broadcast news, that we are in a period where there is a lot of uncertainty, volatility, and change in the media environment. I mean, we talk about things like the Twitter revolution, and we take it for granted that even, you know, a congressional representative sitting on the floor of Congress listening to the president give a State of the Union address is going to be Twittering about that. We take all of that for granted, but, you know, Twitter is only a few years old, and who knows if we'll have it 5 years from now. Similarly, Facebook and social networking sites are new, and so we're in a period where there's lots of new technology, and what that means is that in comparison to a situation where everyone had to go to basically the same place to get their information, there is now a bewildering number of gates through which political information of all sorts passes. And the kind of the paradox or puzzle or challenge of this period for me is that on the one hand, I think it is clear beyond any reasonable doubt that we have at our fingertips more higher quality, diverse information available to us. I can go on the computer that sits in my office and I can find out what the English, well, limited by my language abilities, what English language newspapers in Pakistan are writing today. I can get information all during the day. And of all sorts of quality. The question is whether individual citizens are going to use it or not.
To you listening in, I'm curious, ever talk to people whose political viewpoints are significantly different than your own? If so, when you talk to them, what have you discovered about their sources of news and information? How do those sources differ from your own? Your voice is welcome in this conversation. 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone, or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. Taking a look at where we've been with news and where we are going with Bruce Williams. We continue in 1 minute.
Well, I got nothing against the press. They wouldn't print it if it wasn't true. If you want to know about the gay politician, if you wanna know how to drive your car, if you wanna know about the new sex position, you can read it in the Sunday papers. Read it in the Sunday papers.
Joe Jackson singing about the Sunday papers in a somewhat ironic way. More than 30 years ago, back in 1979, how long ago was it since you regularly read Sunday papers? Maybe you're still reading them on a regular basis today. You have any views about what the news business looks like today, about what your sources of news are today versus how they've been in the past, or what you think they might be like in the future? You're welcome to join our conversation at 1-888-WMRA-TALK. By the way, let me tell you that our guest, Bruce Williams, is a reformed political scientist. Well, he taught political science at Penn State and the University of Michigan. all the time becoming more fascinated at the intersection between media and politics. He then served for a number of years as director of the Institute for Communications Research at the University of Illinois. Today, Bruce Williams is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Bruce Williams, what do you think of Fox News?
I think that it's a perhaps the most well-known example of how changed the media environment is today. First of all, it's something that emerges out of the expansion of television outlets with the growth of cable television. And it's something that I think was driven economically, as we've talked before, to try and maximize its viewership so that it could sell more ads. And it found that there, especially after 9/11, that there was a lot of money to be made by positioning your cable news station in a partisan manner, that it would provide a conservative slant on the news. And over the years, what's happened is that it's not so much Fox News, I think, that has changed and is troubling. It's more the media environment around Fox News. So it is possible for someone to be incredibly interested in the political world around them, to be as good a citizen as we can imagine, and spend all their time, and now it's possible to spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just attending to Fox News. And there is good survey evidence that when you do that, that obviously affects what you think is going on in the world, the facts of the matter, as I will, as I mentioned before. And what you don't have is either the kind of consensus source of information that's coming out of professional journalists as we used to, or you don't have the habit, perhaps, or people don't feel the responsibility to look a lot at other sources of information that are coming from a different perspective. And that's one, it's not the only reason, but I think it's one of the reasons that we find politics in the United States so polarized today. I watch, because it's my job, I watch a lot of Fox News. And it is really, it's fascinating to me because the way they move between things that are called a regular news broadcast, sort of, and then clearly and unabashedly partisan shows is kind of interesting. I have enormous respect for Shepard Smith, the reporter on Fox News, because he did some, what I think, especially coming from Fox News, very courageous and important reporting around Katrina, where he argued against the spin that Fox was trying to put on Katrina to make the Bush administration look good. And I think that the issue is less what Fox is doing than how citizens themselves are responding or not responding to this change in the media environment. Michael and I think that whatever time you spend with media today, rather than spending all of it with a single source, you ought to graze, that you ought to look around, look for other sources of information. And that is one of the habits that was not encouraged in, or possible, really, in the age of broadcast news.
We just got this from Carolyn on our Facebook page, which may speak to the other side of what you were just looking at. She says, perhaps I should be embarrassed to say this, but lots of my news comes from Jon Stewart and The Daily Show. Yes, it also comes from NPR, and I do read the Sunday newspapers, Washington Post and local Charlottesville paper. But no one cuts through the BS like Mr. Stewart.
There's no reason to be embarrassed for that. You know, my take on something like The Daily Show is that it is a product of a changed media environment. You know, when I was young, long ago. And I spent my day out and about working or going to school or whatever. And if I'd read a newspaper in the morning, when I got home at the end of the day, I really had no way of knowing what had gone on during the day. At that point, what I and most other citizens, I think, needed was what the network news provided. That is basically a 30-minute headline service to talk to show you just what important things happened that day. And I think that it served its media time relatively well. But that world doesn't exist anymore. When I get home at the end of the day, my computer has been on all day long. I know what the big stories are. I don't need someone to tell me what the 7 or 8 most important things that happened that day were. Further, I'm not used anymore to sitting down and watching a particular media broadcast at a particular time. I can time shift, TiVo, do all sorts of watch things online. So my needs have changed. And I think that at the end of the day, when people who are paying attention to the world around them, when they get to the end of their day, I think that they need what Jon Stewart provides. And at his best, I think that The Daily Show and The Colbert Report provide a perspective from people that you get to know and trust. That is The Daily Show, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. And they provide a way of thinking about the media that we've consumed all day. They give us a kind of way of critically thinking about the stories that we have been enmeshed in all day. And it's important to remember that two things. First of all, that all of the survey data that gets done suggests that the audience for The Daily Show is amongst the most informed audiences in the certainly television media world. And one of the reasons for that is, as our questioner said, when you arrive at The Daily Show, you better know something about the stories that they're talking about, or it's going to be very hard to understand the humor. And the humor is another part of it, because Jon Stewart has to hold his audience every day. The nightly network news broadcast didn't have to do that because there was nothing else on. And now you have to hold an audience. And so I think that there's also data, the survey that suggested that actually the two most informed audiences in terms of if you ask them facts about what's happening in the political world are the audience for The Daily Show and the audience for The O'Reilly Factor. And I think the reason for that is because people that come to that show are looking around. They're pretty well informed when they get to the end of the day.
It seems to me, Bruce Williams, author of the book After Broadcast News, that the problem some people who are not conservatives have with the difference between the two elements that we just discussed is that The Daily Show with Jon Stewart is obviously a comedy show. It comments on the news. The host seems to obviously be quite liberal, although he sometimes criticizes Democrats as much as he criticizes Republicans. But it's on Comedy Central. The Fox News channel is called Fox News. And some people who don't share the conservative perspective recoil, saying, that's not news. It seems to me that part of the argument that you're making is, well, if you lived most any other time in history other than maybe the past 70 or 80 years in America, you would see it as news. Because most of the time when people got information from any kind of political perspective, there wasn't the expectation that it was not going to have some sort of slant, or there wasn't going to be the interest of the sender involved.
Or that it would be kind of white-knuckle serious. You know, if you look at the front pages of newspapers in the 20s and 30s, they were very sensational. But I think the question about how to understand either Fox News or Jon Stewart raises another question that I think is kind of one of the questions about this new media environment, and that is, what are the responsibilities and obligations of Jon Stewart or Bill O'Reilly? How do you criticize Jon Stewart for not covering a story or getting the facts wrong or, you know, saying you're not really doing what you're supposed to, because it's clear, at least to me, that his show is one of the main sources of political information for a lot of people, as is everything on Fox News. And if they say, as Bill O'Reilly, Jon Stewart, and Sean Hannity would be the first to say, you can't hold me to the standards of journalists because that's not what I'm doing, that's fair enough. But what are the standards?
Bruce Williams, we're running short on time, so I wanted to make sure that we got to a little bit of what you think we're headed toward in terms of news in the future or information that people use to make their political decisions, whether we call it news or not. And I want to combine that with this question that just came in, or comment from Mark, that hints at what the future might be. He says, if the populace is not going to spend time verifying their sources, what hope is there that all this wonderful information will lead to the truth of a particular matter? Each person has to vet his own news sources now and do so diligently. Is that part of what you expect for the future of information?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that on the one hand, one of the things that becomes very important, again, is what I would call media literacy, or how we educate people when they're going all through school and certainly public school and then colleges and universities as well, how we educate them in terms of how they evaluate the different sources of information that are available to them, how they think about and compare maybe what they might find on the BBC as opposed to what they might find on, the site Cracked, which is kind of humorous.
You don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not asking you to predict what kind of new technologies that will influence information are going to show up in the next 6 years or 6 months or 6 days. Yeah. But in terms of what's likely to be our source of information upon which we base important decisions as citizens in a democracy, how do you see that 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now?
I'm an academic, so I'm going to give you the frustrating answer is it depends. But I mean that in kind of a really serious way, to get us back to the idea of media regimes. And these are outcomes that are not just going to happen because of the communication technology or things like that. They're going to be a product of political decisions and political will. And I think that, you know, if you think about the internet, on the one hand, this is a medium that was developed through government research dollars when it began, and still for a lot of people, it is celebrated as a medium that really allows the free flow of information, consulting wide ranges of sources. It has this interactive quality and on and on. But there's a battle that's going on in Congress right now over, and it comes up in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's over what we call net neutrality. At other times, as right now, it's over copyright and how you protect that. And I think that there are, certainly if you talk about producers of content like Hollywood movie studios, they would like to see, in the end, the internet look pretty much like what Neil Postman, the media critic, called cable television on steroids, that it will be a medium that simply streams content produced by someone else into our homes. Whether the internet retains its capacity to mobilize individuals, or whether in 20 years we look back and say, well, there are a lot of possibilities there now, but I'm just going to go back to watching, Transformers 27 on my high-definition computer monitor, I think those are decisions that are made right now, and a lot turns on them.
Part of the takeaway I'm getting, both from reading your book After Broadcast News and listening to you here in the studio, Bruce Williams, is that much of how our previous understanding of news during this era of broadcast news developed was because of government regulation. And much of what may happen in the future with the internet or other technologies that affect how we get information may also depend on what happens with government regulation?
I think that's inevitable. And I think that's always been true from the earliest days of the American Republic, when the postal system was set up and political information was subsidized. There's no such thing as a free lunch or a free market or libertarian media.
Our guest has been Bruce Williams, lead author of the new book, After Broadcast News, as well as a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. Bruce, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Tom.
It seems to me that you also, in your book, have a note of hope for people who want to influence politics because you think social media can be really powerful.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, and I
so
think, yes.
We'll encourage people to look at the book and
yes.
find out more on that.
Available on Amazon.com.
Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.